Welcome to the ABCDA podcast, episode 8. I'm Ruchira Tripathi, and this is Career Journeys. And of course, I have with me my lovely co-host, Felicity Brown. Hi, Felicity.
Hi, Ruchira. Hi, everyone.
Felicity and I will be speaking to AB Jacob today. And let me give you a quick snapshot of AB, and then we'll get down to the conversation. AB is the chief future-proofist at Future Proof Global, which is a business transformation consulting firm. And he's also held senior leadership roles at Ecolab, Accelerate, Transnational Research Institute, and Nautil Networks. Welcome to the show, AB.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
AB, tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a little bit of a spice on you. How would you describe yourself if you were to introduce yourself to somebody?
First of all, I think I try to be a very authentic person, right? So I don't want to wake up being someone to my family and then going to the office and taking on a completely different role and persona. I try to be an authentic person in all facets of my life. And that's important to me too. I think work-wise, I've been very blessed because I spent almost 30 years working for multinationals in Singapore, in Australia, in the US, and so on. And then in the last 5 years, or 4 years rather, I have had the opportunity to start my own company, right? To be an entrepreneur, which is a whole different ball game altogether. Yeah, so that's how Future Proof came about. But also more importantly, I think I've had a very lengthy career in the army as a reservist or as a national serviceman. So some of the skills that I acquired there around leadership, operations, processes, and things, it's priceless that has helped me very much so in my commercial world and experience as well.
Interesting. So tell us about Future Proof Global. You mentioned that you started this about 5 years ago. So what problem are you seeking to tackle through that? Why did you decide to start it?
Okay, somewhere towards the tail end of my career with Ecolab, I was just glancing through jobs, job sites, job applications, and I realized that even as a HR practitioner previously, I didn't understand what were some of the jobs that were being put out there. And I said, if I'm not understanding this as a HR person, how is the common man or woman going to understand what's being put out there? So I researched this for a while, and I realized that one of the glaring gaps at that time in my life was knowledge of digital transformation or going digital. And to my great dismay or humor, whichever way you look at it, I realized that the fourth industrial revolution was already upon us. We were not predicting, or in 20 years' time when the fourth industrial, no, it was already upon us, right? So I also realized that a lot of companies were struggling with this, right? The common thing is, oh, we have no budget. Oh, no, we can't do sustainability. It has to be sustainability or digital or neither, because we don't have the money for this. And so I started getting my own act together by getting a certification in digital transformation and all of that to fill in some of the gaps. And then I realized that when it came to things like disruption, companies were slow to it because they didn't know how to respond to this. And if you didn't have a strategy to start with, except a product and I'm going to sell this and make money, then when something like disruption hits you, you are in a very vulnerable place. And so whether you're a multinational or a small and medium-sized enterprise, I realized that this was a significant gap, right? And this is just one, right? The response to disruption or having a strategy. Now, the second part of this was around people development. So a lot of companies say there's no talent. Right? And globally, there's this throwaway line called there's lack of talent. I don't believe so. I think there's a lack of opportunities or belief in the capability of people, and the reluctance to invest in development is what is causing this, or investing in the wrong thing. The third one, I think I came to believe that you needed to go digital and adopt sustainability at the same time, regardless of your budget. So when I put this together, that's how Future Proof came about, because my mission was to future proof organizations and keep them relevant in the fourth industrial revolution and tell them how they could go about it. Now, I cannot say you must have a strategy, you must know how to respond to disruption, you must do ESG, you must do digital all at the same time. right? But you must have a roadmap that says that if I'm going to be a continue to be a player, big or small, in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years' time, then I need to map out this roadmap to say what I'm going to do when in order to remain relevant. So that was the origins of Future Proof.
Good. AB, I want to actually revisit or connect the dots a little bit because your background, you're quite the Renaissance person. You like so many things, and you've even your career, as we try to unpack it today, it's quite unusual, the journey that you've had. So tell me, I want to start with your childhood a little bit. What was that like, and how were you as a child? I find it hard to imagine how the little AB would be. Like, were you this hyperactive kid into tons of things, into sports? What were you like as a young person?
Sorry, you lost me at Renaissance, man. Okay, just kidding. Okay, I think my childhood was good. We were not rich or flashy or anything, but I didn't lack for anything. Prior to this podcast, when you sent me this, I was thinking, what is... Yeah, and I wasn't an ambitious person. I was the last person to say I want to be a doctor or a engineer or a Air Force pilot or a, you know, commercial pilot. I didn't have any of that. I just, every year was just do your best. Just do your best. Nobody forced me to be anything, but it is just do your best. I think somewhere in 1973, when I look back at this, right, my mom, who was a teacher, St. Thomas Secondary School went from being a private school to a government-aided school. So the government told them, okay, listen, we have our own sets of books that we want to bring it, so empty your library. And my mother, who loves books, found it very difficult to see thousands of books going into the dustbin. And believe it or not, and I'm not kidding, I think about 25% of those books ended up in my house and in my bedroom because there was no other space. So every night I'd pull out one book and just leaf through it, right? So whether it was history of the Roman Empire or whether it was philosophy or whether it was the Division I English football, World Cup, anything, right? So I guess over a period of time, I acquired several different interests without realizing it. Right? And I think that's how I found things fascinating, right? There's a lot of breath-wise, there's a lot of things to learn and things like that. Sports-wise, I think I came from a family of sports people, so I was interested in all sorts of sports, from soccer to track and field and softball, baseball, yeah, anything but swimming. So that's what I was. But I don't think any of this kind of manifested itself for me until I went to the army, Singapore Armed Forces. I think that's where I was given an appointment for which there was no training during our officer cadet days. So I had to learn everything from various people, various sources from scratch, and ended up writing the SOP for the position I was holding. And it was a fairly senior position for someone who was only 19 or 20 years old. Yeah, and we did really well operationalizing the battalion at my age, and I was like number two in the battalion, right? When I left the army to do my basic degree at National University of Singapore, I must say, I did not feel like a late teenager or young adult going to school. I felt like an adult who had done many different things and was looking for some serious major challenges even in year one. So I think these are some of the things that have come together and shaped me in a big way.
You speak about army. This is the second time that you've spoken about army. So it seems like it was quite a defining experience for you in your life journey. Do you think it was the early responsibility that was the piece which was defining, or was that something else over there in that experience? Was it like the friends you made, or what was it in that experience that you felt was helpful or defining for you?
Camaraderie is always good, right? Making friends everywhere and having them as lifelong friends is really good. It's powerful too, right? I think in that senior position, I was giving orders to my course mates from Officer Cadet School, and that was a different experience because we grew up together, we trained together, we got punished together, we drank together, we played pranks on one another. But when you are given a higher position than them, then you have to learn from scratch what it means to give orders to the people at the same level as you. I think that was number one. Number two, to see the big picture, right? It is critical in the army that you don't just say, this is what we're going to do, but we are doing this because the headquarters above us is doing this and the one above that. So you're always approaching things from a big picture perspective. I think that singularly has defined who I am in the workforce, because if someone comes and says, "Why, AB, I need you to do this," I'll always ask them, why? What is it that we are trying to do? Give me the big picture, so that when I talk to my people who are implementing this, they understand what the big picture around this is, and it cuts short my change management time. People spend a lot of time, money, resources throwing at change management, but if the people below understand what is happening up there and why we need to effect this change or do something, you cut short your change management time. I think, and the third thing that the army helped me with was precise communication, right? You didn't beat around the bush when you gave orders. You didn't tell a long story. There was no storytelling. It was mission, right? So those things around mission and how to convey the mission in the most precise terms, these are two things also I took away from the army.
AB, if I can ask, I'm interested, like when you were finishing secondary school, what did you think you were going to be doing with your life back then?
I think that was defined by my grades, right? So I thought I'd try and be a lawyer or I wouldn't say teacher because that was the furthest thing from my mind, but just a business executive, so to speak, right? Mm. Somewhere in the business. And I didn't specify that I wanted to be in oil and gas or biotechnology or anything like that. Just somewhere in the business and or law, right? I used to be told that it's good that I didn't become a lawyer because I'd be giving away too many things for free, pro bono.
Why did you not want to be a teacher? I can understand that because I come from a family of teachers, but I want to hear your version.
Yeah, that's exactly the same for me, Ruchi. When I was growing up, my parents are both teachers, and it's very interesting for those who don't have teachers as parents, because I always tell them, I didn't speak till I became 18 and went to the army, because every time I tried to say something, I'd get two sets of voices telling me what to do and what I was doing wrong. And so I said, no, anything but teaching. But later when I became a trainer, became a great source of, I don't know, happiness to my father to keep reminding me, right? See, I told you you'd be a teacher.
How did you, so you said that your first degree in the biological sciences, it was defined by your grades, which meant that if you have good grades, you get into the sciences, but then still you ended up choosing biology amongst all the sciences. So was that because you had the highest grades in that field, or was there some kind of interest? How did you make that choice?
Hardly the grades, but I think interest-wise, I was always a science student, so interest-wise, it was a no-brainer for me. And to connect it with today's interview, in my father's day, if you had a diploma, it was good enough, right, to get a job. In my time, you just needed a degree. Unless it was a professional degree of being a doctor, lawyer, engineer, accountant, any degree would get you a job. It didn't matter, right? So that's how. But by the final year in university, I did know that I didn't want to wash test tubes anymore or be in a lab, for sure. So I went out there and looked for a sales job. I also had some interest in journalism by then, but the time and space didn't work out. So I went and did a sales job initially, which was great because my first job was in the Straits Times in Singapore. And they didn't say you have to be, they did assign us to sectors, but I had the opportunity to learn about many different multiple industries from the get-go and how a newspaper operated, because it doesn't just involve selling ad space. It involves understanding how editorial runs the show, how pagination gets done, the artwork, the circulation process, the manufacturing process, production process. So it like for the first 3 years, I had a wide expanse of things to learn and to be able to speak to, right? Because if something happened to the client's ad, they'd come and see the salesperson, not the editorial people. And so that the salesperson, that's me, I'd have to explain to them, this is what happened, this is why it happened, when it happened, how many papers were, newspapers were affected, this is the production process, nothing, and so on. So it was really expansive learning for me in my first job.
So if you are to look back and connect the dot, do you think you've gone, and this is not just the initial part of your career, it's also the various positions that you've held. Do you think you've gone with your interests, or do you think you've gone with opportunities that have come your way, or do you think you've gone with opportunities that you think would future-proof your career? How have you made some of these career decisions for yourself?
Okay, so going back to the tail end of the army, I realized that if I could do that at age 19 or 20, I didn't have to fear anything, right? In today's organizations, when I consult or see young people, they are stuck to the roles that they have. If I'm in finance, I have to be in finance till I become the vice president of something in finance. You ask them to do something else, be part of agile team, as you call it these days, they're like, oh no, it's got nothing to do with finance, it won't help my career. This is not something I experienced. So when I left the Straits Times, I went to a training company, which was a joint venture between the National Productivity Board then and Singapore Airlines, to raise the national level of service quality in Singapore. Now, to any person who I was working with the previous 3 years, they would say I would have gone on to a great career in advertising. Did I like advertising? Yes. Was it up my alley? Yes. But I felt that I could hit the ground running in a training company, and they wanted us to train as well as learn consulting. So I just took that as I can hit the ground running and I'm going to learn something. So I used both of that to say, yep, I'll join you guys. And so the second company, I trained a lot. I trained a lot. The trainers I worked with were also, if you look at them today, right, we all became world-class trainers. And even if we stuck to training all our lives or went on to do other things or went into human resources, doesn't matter. But that second company where we were training quite a bit added a new dimension to who I was, as well as a skill set that I didn't have up to that point. They couldn't stop me talking after that.
So you're saying that you went with interests then. That's how you probably...
Yeah.
Not so much with what was the right path or what others would have suggested, but maybe with your gut feel or what was of interest to you is how you navigated.
Yeah, because in 1994, the internet kind of came onto the market, right, at scale. And so a year later, I was talking to my friends who were in multinationals then, and I realized that I was already two steps behind them, right? So I looked for a job in a bank or an IT company or a telco, and I got picked up by Nortel Networks, right? And they couldn't give me a sales job because up to that point, I'd been doing all sales with a bit of training, but this was no sales because you're not an engineer. So I came in as an internal consultant, and whatever I had learned in my first 6 years and from the army enabled me to start talking big picture, how you break it down, how you're going to do this, what kind of orders need to be given to get this tactical part up and running. So that went on for about 18 months. And then I had the opportunity to become the HR director. It's how do I put it? It's an act of God, really. I was nowhere near this realm. I wasn't interested in HR, but it came about. And my first job was to do massive restructuring and layoffs across Asia Pacific. Again, no SOPs to fall back on. Had to write them all myself. I remember my boss and I sitting at 8 o'clock at night saying, where should we start? You think a policy would be good? Yes, yes, good. Let's write a policy. Unpleasant exercise, but so much to learn from it. And military execution also helped my team and I to execute it in a way that was palatable to those affected. We treated them in a very dignified manner, severance packages and so on. Again, multiple experiences from the past helped in getting or moving these things. But I didn't stay in HR for too long. I went on back into the business because by that time in Nortel, I was like the go-to guy. You have a problem? Talk to AB. Your business unit is crumbling? Talk to AB. customer satisfaction not good, talk to AB. I can't go back and say how it all evolved, but that was a kind of towards the end, that was how it was. And so I went back to the business to do bid management and pricing, commercial marketing for Asia South Pacific. Interestingly, the dot-com crash came about, and while we were churning out many proposals and bids, the bottom had fallen out of the capital market. So there was really not much happening at that time, which is why I decided to go and do my MBA at that point in time. Nortel was a company way ahead of its time. It just lost its way towards the end, and it's a sad case study.
AB, it sounds very strategic, your career decision making. You said sometimes you have a bit of luck as well, but it also sounds quite strategic. When you reflect back on your career, who do you think influenced you the most?
I had a few good mentors along the way in the military, in my first three jobs, as well as in Nortel Networks. So I think when I spoke to them, they gave me sound advice. And sometimes when I had plans that dear and near to me, they would say, this is probably not what you should be doing. But again, it's your choice, right? So I learned how to be a good mentor through people like them as well, right? Not giving solutions and getting emotional about it, but just be there, be a listening ear for other people. But I would say strategy in planning my career was probably about 30%, because whatever I planned didn't really come to fruition. But I think the situations I was in enabled me to decide on the next steps.
Yeah, you're weighing up what was around you. Oh, this isn't working at the moment. Maybe now's time to do my MBA, or yeah, maybe I need to move into banking or telecommunications. So you moved into Nortel. So I could see there was some strategy there too, but
yeah,
I guess that there were other factors at play.
Yeah, but up to this point, I must say that I came to learn that leadership is all important. You just have to look at an organization, whether it's military or commercial or whatever. And if you see non-performers, people without motivation, it's just a general blah, and you go to the organization, it all falls back on leadership. When you see motivated people running around, it's not because of the sales commission, it's because of motivated leaders, right? In some of my work in Rotary right now, I go to Siem Reap, Cambodia to do projects, and I can see that there's schools where people just say, oh, just give me the money and I'll figure out what to do with it, versus principals of schools who are like, no, I want my children to go digital. I want them to enter the workforce of the future. So leadership is always a critical component of what I say makes a good organization. And leadership is important not unto itself, but because it helps create culture. So whenever I talk to people and I say culture, you can see some people rolling their eyeball, that's too big of an animal to handle. But I say, better to handle this animal than to go double the time just solving operational needs. Because if you have a culture of good leadership and good leadership building a great culture, you'll find that your organization worries less about problem solving, but growth.
AB, what I find really interesting about you as a person is that the examples that you are giving, those examples are all to do with very structured environments. You talk a lot about the army. You talked about your initial years, about your parents, which seemed, I got a sense that it was maybe a little bit of a structured setup at home as well. But you have come out of this very structured environment and you've become this person who's greatly agile and immensely adaptable. And those pieces, even the takeaways that you've had from these very structured environments, are feeding into this kind of an approach or a mindset that you have. And I'm really curious to know, how have you developed this? Because I think this is something that's very important, especially in the Singaporean context.
Okay, this is the part where I talk a little bit about learning agility, right? I didn't know what learning agility was until the Lohminger model came about, right? They've been bought over by Korn Ferry. But looking at learning agility, it made me realize that the most important thing there that anybody, whether you are starting off your career or whether you are entering into a senior management C-suite role, or even you've been there for a while, is really self-awareness. And sometimes people think that self-awareness is about journaling. And I say, hardly. Right. I won't say early in my career, but maybe after 8 or 10 years or something, I started looking at myself and say, what am I about? Who am I? What difference am I making to this world? Right. Normally, I heard things like this appear at age 45, but for me, it was probably age 30, right? So I structured my life around what's important to me, what are my values in life, what are the facets of my life. Things can change over time, but I'd write down and then I'd write the goals associated with the different facets of my life. And I'd revisit it every 3 to 6 months and saying, especially like when you're doing massive restructuring, mergers and acquisitions and things like that, you are living, breathing, eating and dreaming these things. It's like a 24/7, right? So after 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, you come back and say, I haven't done anything else in my life, or I've forgotten where my path was. So I'll revisit this and then, what do you call it, realign myself. I think that's part of the self-awareness process. So even when I'm teaching learning agility, I always tell people, don't focus on your mental agility results. It's self-awareness, right? If you know who you are, you'll be very clear in your life about what you want out of it and how you can be useful. I think that directly answers in my mind what you are asking. I cannot say that it was attributable to my parents or my teachers or my colleagues or anything, but when I started doing this, and I didn't realize that immediately, but years later, I realized, I said, wow, it's quite a journey and quite some learnings for myself. Yeah, so that's what's happened.
So you always had this HR person in you, you just didn't know it.
In my final year in university, we all were forced to take a subject, a module called human resources. And I answered way too many questions. And the lecturer said, one day you'll make a great HR person. I literally laughed her out of the room. I just said, oh, good try. And I walked out. So there you go.
Yeah, this all this talk about self-awareness, it's very much like what we do as career development practitioners. So this comes very naturally to you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I will also say that after I did my MBA, I realized that if you want to be a good leader, you must have mastery over your field, your chosen field, right? You cannot say, I'm saying this in line with today's generation that, you know, they want to change jobs, go where the money is, where the new roles are and all that. Nothing wrong with that. It's the times have changed. I would never, ever impose my generation's views on them or how to run their careers, but I will say that having mastery over your chosen field is very important. If you are an investment banker, you better know everything there is to know about investment banking. Right? HR is slightly different because the recruitment person will say, my job is recruitment, don't bother me about any other thing. The comp and ben person will say, oh, don't bother me about recruitment, and so on. It goes around. So for me, my area of mastery is learning and development. But I also know that if you want to run a successful HR team, these elements of recruitment, comp and ben training have to come together because I'll just give you a small example. When you say, what is my talent management strategy? You're not talking about talent management for 300 people. You're talking about a select group of people who are your high potentials, your scarce skills, your critical resources, those you want to retain in the company, those you want to develop. How are you going to do that? So not one person can come up with the answer. A group of people have to come together and define that strategy of how you will run talent management in the company. So mastery is important. I think for those who want to move up in their career, leadership is important. And leadership, you can gain it by attending a university program, right? Or you can be part of a cross-functional agile team that gets you exposed to other people in your organization, gets you exposed to working with your peers, gets you exposed to working on your company's most significant problems and things like that. And that's how you develop leadership, right? We always talk about lighting a fire under a high potential seat. I believe strongly in that, right? If they come back and say, I don't have the skills, therefore I don't want to do this, fine. Then I don't think I will classify you as a high potential, no matter how good your grades are or how well you talk or position yourself, right? Leadership, because as I mentioned earlier, building a culture is critical to an organization's survival. This is what I would say, mastery of your area of expertise, and leadership.
So what's next for you, AB?
Oh, okay. Very interesting. So I got into sustainability in 2007. because I read a book called Capitalism at the Crossroads, and it talked about sustainability, right? But these were old days where university professors were coming up with all this, and it takes a lot of time for university professors to get it out into the marketplace. But things were moving faster than normal, and so I got really interested in this and started reading up other books like The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, The End of Poverty by Jeffrey Sachs, and things like that. And it made me realize that this thing that has been bothering me about how do I give back, what is my contribution, how can I help other people, it came to the forefront. But of course, sustainability, which is wrapped in its current form called ESG, has only made its appearance in the last 8 years. Yeah. I cannot say I'm an expert or a master on ESG because things are evolving so fast. And this comes to the change that I'm about to speak to. I was asked recently by a client, how are you going to use AI to solve my sustainability problem? And I said, good question. I have no answer. I have no idea. Because instead of taking years to be a master, now you're starting to learn one topic and the next topic is already upon you. And people can't even answer what is the difference between digital transformation and AI. You can, if you read up, you can, right? And for many people, AI equals ChatGPT, right? So these are very simplified versions of getting through things. But if you ask me, I need to find a way to integrate AI into everything that I do. That means my personal life as well as my work life. Because you're not going to run away from this, right? Just like sustainability is not going to go away because climate change is on our doorstep. It's not only our doorstep. You just look at the weather from last week and you'll know that it's not right. So while people are doing sustainability and ESG and all of that, you have to open your eyes and mind and get to know about AI and things like this. There's no running away from this. So that's what I'd like to do. So again, no rest for the wicked. I'm back on this steep learning curve, right? So fortunately, I still have the energy.
I'm going to ask the last question, but I wanted to ask Felicity, do you have any questions for AB before we wrap up?
I wonder, what's the best piece of career advice or the worst piece of career advice that you have received?
I think the best career advice I have received is to be bold, right? Like I mentioned earlier, if I think I can do parts of a new role or parts of a new job, but there's an opportunity for me to learn on the job, just do it. Don't wait to be trained before you do something, right? As people like to say, I don't need a Panadol to get started. It's true. And my mentors did the same thing, and I've seen them be successful at whatever they step into. So today we'll call that learning agility, but you know, that is what worst career advice I think I put on myself is to do a full-time MBA during the dot-com crisis, because things have never been the same since, right? If you have the money and you're willing to give up your monthly salary to do a full-time MBA or master's, good for you. But if not, you should carefully consider what you're doing, because that weight of an MBA, unless you're from a Harvard, London Business School, Stanford or something, people don't really put too much weight on that, especially those who don't have a master's, if you know what I mean. That had caused my career to stutter a little bit, but no great damage done. I'm still very happy that I did my MBA at Thunderbird, and I also did my master's in environmental management from NUS, because my wife insisted that if you can talk so much, go get a second master's. And I said, okay, dear.
Nice. We've come to the end of the session. Thank you so much for sharing your journey with us, AB. I want to wrap this up with any final words of wisdom that you may have for our listeners, especially our young listeners, some of whom may be starting out on their careers. So
yeah,
what would you want to say to them?
It's a really exciting time to be in the world today, right? You have just so many things you can do, problems you can solve, right? From climate change to organization issues to social issues. Right, there's a governance issue. There's so many things you can be engaged in and be part of. So look at it with wide open eyes. Look at all these opportunities with wonder. Go do different things that you have not been involved in. Serve the community. use your skills, because people always tell me, I'm so tired, I'm so tired. But yes, there will come a time when you can sleep forever, but wait till that day. Right now is the time to be alive and do whatever you can. But as I said two or three times, whatever you choose to do, be a master at your labor and always cultivate leadership skills so that you can build a culture. Yeah, do not be afraid. There's enough space and time and things for you guys to do. It's really exciting time to be alive.
Thank you so much, AB. Thank you for your wisdom and for being so candid with us about your journey and the nuggets that you've learned over the years.
Thank you, Ruchi. Thank you, Felicity. An honor to be invited. Thank you.